Since I was last doing this, it feels just like a few months to me. And really, so much has happened, as Brother Richard says, hasn't it, in the last 12 months. It's been quite astounding, hasn't it, to have witnessed all the things that we have seen. And that headline there, the year when a lot happened, isn't my headline. When I was putting this together, I was looking on the BBC website, and they did a review of 2011, and that was their headline. The year when a lot happened. And they listed out some of the key things that had happened in 2011. And they kept using the word historic and remarkable and astounding and all these sorts of words. And they were talking about the riots, and they were talking about the revolutions. They were talking about the natural disasters that we've seen. You know, absolutely catastrophic, one might even say cataclysmic natural disasters this year. They were talking about the crisis in Europe and how the events this year are reshaping Europe with the crisis with the euro. They were talking about the Middle East and all the problems that are there in Iran and obviously in Syria. And they were comparing it, as we'll see, to other cataclysmic years. And they went all the way back to 1848 and compared to what's happening now to incredible events back then. And if we get chance, we might touch on that when we look at Revelation 16 and actually see that the events of the French Revolution are indeed a comparable year to what we see now. And Revelation 16 also remarkably covers both of those events as well. So what I thought we'd do is, just for the first little bit, I'm not going to be quoting anything from the Bible. I'm just going to remind you of some of those key events I've just been talking about. Got some video clips and bits and pieces and some headlines. This is an hour, okay? So there's an enormous amount of information that we've got to try and squeeze into an hour, and it means there's a huge amount that we're not going to cover. And you might think to yourself, well, why didn't you mention that? Because I thought that was really important, and I guess, you know, I'm looking at it through my eyes, so forgive me for that. But these are the things that stood out to me when I was going through all the slides at the end of the year to say, you know, what really does stand out in 2011. When we've had a look at that, what I'll then do, we'll turn to the scriptures. So we'll pretty much switch that off, and we'll just open the Bible and try and fit in all the events that we've been looking at into the scriptures to see if they do sort of really tie up. And if we've got any time left after that, what I might do is, and I don't normally do this, but have a think about what might happen in 2012. And I don't know why I'm doing that bit, because I don't normally like, I've never done that before, but we're on the cusp of so many things. I might do it, but then again, we might get beaten on time. So let's crack on then. Here are some headlines. These headlines are all around natural disasters. The interesting thing was, when I was looking at the weekly World Watch slides and putting them into themes, picking out all the ones that are relating to natural disasters, there were 39. Slides this year in relation to natural disasters. When I look back to 2003 when I started it, for those years up to about 2009, the average number of slides in relation to natural disasters was between 15 and 20. So it just that, on my very rough weekly World Watch slide gauge, says to me there's been a huge amount more activity in the earth. So at the beginning of the year, we had, this is a headline, Australia's Queensland Faces Biblical Flood. That was this time pretty much last year, if you remember that. So we've got a biblical flood there. We had the Christchurch earthquake, the darkest day for New Zealand, and we've had more recent earthquakes there again, haven't we, I think, in just the recent weeks. A once-in-a-century storm hits Massachusetts. The White House was evacuated because there was an earthquake in Washington, an extremely rare one. I mean, it didn't kill anybody, but it grounded the aircraft, and the White House was evacuated. A deadly tornado outbreak in the south, maybe the worst in American history. Brazil floods, worst ever natural disaster as death toll rises. And I could have just gone on and on putting in headlines like that, but I sort of run out of space. And it gives you some idea, doesn't it, as to the things that have been happening. And that doesn't include the biggest of the loss, of course, which was the tsunami, which happened on March the 11th this year. It goes on for a few minutes. I'll pause it there. Over 20,000 people were killed in that earthquake. It happened on March the 11th. On March the 11th, 2010, the government of Japan made a statement about Israel. And it said exactly these words. The government of Japan deplores the decisions of the government of Israel to give permission for the construction of 1,600 housing units in East Jerusalem, in addition to the 112 units in the West Bank. The government of Japan does not recognise any act that prejudices the final status of Jerusalem and the territories in the pre-1967 borders. Japan demands that the plans should not be implemented. That was on the 11th of March 2010, and on the 11th of March 2011, that government that cursed Israel suffered one of the worst crises, if not the worst, in many, many decades. And, of course, it wasn't just the tsunami. There was the nuclear reactor that was affected and the radiation leak. And only a week after that, a volcano started erupting in Japan as well. And their economy has really severely been affected. So that was, you know, when you see those scenes, I know the picture's a bit blurred because when we copied it down, it loses quite a lot of its focus there. But, you know, there are amazing pictures, aren't they, as we see the sea pouring over like that. And, of course, it was only a few years ago. There was the Boxing Day tsunami, wasn't it? And so suddenly in the last few years, we're seeing tsunamis, which I don't remember seeing tsunamis like this coming one after the other, as we're seeing now. I'll just show you this clip here. These are some tornadoes that touched down in America, causing over 300 deaths. Just have a listen to this.
The South has rarely, if ever, seen a tornado season this bad. The dead number in the hundreds, with many more injured, a million are without power. This is Tuscaloosa in Alabama. A neighborhood called Rosedale has all but ceased to exist. And this was the monstrous tornado that did the damage. It's now clear that this beast, more than a mile wide, traveled the whole way across Alabama and on up into Georgia. It deposited street signs 100 miles from where they belonged. Over six states, 165 tornadoes are thought to have touched down in 24 hours.
165 tornadoes. It's amazing, isn't it? And it was that was just one particular event. The tornado season carried on. And again, in the World Watch, you'd have seen all sorts of horrific storms that were affecting America. Just to give you some idea that things are increasing, I only found this the other day. This is actual just numbers of events that are counted up since 1980 in the United States. So this isn't, you know, people might say, well, if you go back a long time ago, they were unreported, we don't have the internet. And this is 1980, you know, people knew how many events were happening in America and they counted them up. And you can see how the numbers are rising quite dramatically. So that's just sheer numbers of natural disasters in America. And we'll probably hear more about this. This is the Seattle Times. This was just a couple of days ago. Billion-dollar weather disasters smash US record. America smashed the record for billion-dollar weather disasters this year with a deadly dozen and counting. With an almost biblical onslaught of twisters, floods, snow, drought, heat and wildfire, the US in 2011 has seen more weather catastrophes that caused at least $1 billion in damage than it did in all of the 1980s, even after the dollar figures from back then are adjusted for inflation. So a whole decade was squidged into 1 year, in effect, in 2011. Quite remarkable things that have happened. So that's natural disasters. What about what's happening with Israel? What things have happened in relation to Israel? Well, I've just picked out a certain number of slides or headlines here in relation to Israel and about nations actually recognising Palestine as a state in its own right. And there was early on in 2011, Chile recognised a Palestinian state. Ireland upgraded the Palestinian territories. That was in January as well. Palestinians say Russia supports bid for a state. Turkey to vote for Palestine recognition at the United Nations, says the Turkish president. Iceland recognises a Palestinian state. And so it went on. I just want to show you this this particular video clip here. This is UNESCO, which is a United Nations organisation. And in fact, they became the very first United Nations organisation to recognise a Palestinian state. And here's the time, or the very moment, when the vote was taken. And I'm just going to show you this so you can see the reaction of all the nations that were being represented there to Palestine being recognised as a state.
The votes have now been counted. Here is the result. Number of members entitled to vote, 185. Number of members present and voting, 173. Number of abstentions, 52. Majority required, 81. Votes in favor, 107. Votes against 14. Ladies and gentlemen, the General Conference has thus voted to adopt the draft resolution and decided to admit Palestine as member of UNESCO.
Each of those people there represents a nation. And that's the reaction of the world to, in effect, the division of Israel. So we'll probably touch on that a bit later. Of course, the big story during the year were the revolutions, weren't they, that began. And I actually put this headline in the World Watch back in January, before the revolutions began, saying that soaring global food prices sparked fears of social unrest. And literally 3 weeks after that, it was just headline after headline of social unrest. And much of it was caused by soaring global food prices. The man who set himself on fire in Tunisia was a student, a university student, who could not find work. So what he did was grew some vegetables and was literally selling them by the side of the road to earn some money. And when the local police beat him up and threw him in jail because he didn't have a permit for that, when he got out of jail, he set himself on fire and killed himself. Many hundreds of people watched him burning himself to death. And even more, thousands turned up at the funeral. Within 2 weeks, the Tunisian government had fallen, and the riots and the revolutions and riots spread then across into Egypt, which then spread to Tunisia, which then spread to Bahrain, which then spread to Yemen, which then spread to Syria. So one man in poverty, being beaten up by the police, caused this spark, if you like, which has spread, as we'll see in a minute, all around the world. As unrest sweeps Egypt, president refuses to quit, and then within sort of a month, Hosni Mubarak resigned. The Egyptian president falls after 18 days of people protest. Protest wave spreads out over Arab neighbours. Troops open fire as protests explode across Syria. Anti-government protests in 8 Arab countries. Colonel Gaddafi killed. Assad, president of Syria, will be next to fall, declare the Syrians. It's interesting, each time an Arab leader's fallen, it's taken a little bit longer for it to happen. So the Tunisian government fell within days. The Egyptian government fell within weeks. The Libyan government fell within months. And the Syrian president, as we know, is still there. But only just. Just have a little listen to this.
Tunisians gathered today to remember one man who changed the Middle East. Mohamed Bouazizi. His mother addressed the crowd. She tells them her son symbolized the beginning of the revolution and says she appreciates all the martyrs who died this year. Meanwhile, in neighboring Libya, the American Defense Secretary Leon Panetta was in Tripoli to offer congratulations on another move towards democracy.
They have to determine what their needs are, what kind of assistance is required, and whatever they need, the United States will be happy to respond.
Libya's revolution, which climaxed here in what's now called Martyrs Square, was in many ways the most conclusive. A 42-year-long dictatorship ending with Muammar Gaddafi's death. Libyans are still enjoying their revolutionary honeymoon. But across the region, a process of momentous change is far from over. Egypt is still volatile. Clashes in Cairo continue today. These are security forces savagely beating protesters who say the pace of change is too slow. One man eventually tries to get up. A second looks to be unconscious at best. At least 8 people have died since Friday. 11 months after the fall of Hosni Mubarak and halfway through new elections, the future direction of the country is far from clear. And in Yemen this weekend, there were more anti-government protests, even though President Ali Abdullah Saleh finally agreed to step down last month after over 30 years in power. But provoking most concern is Syria. The UN says more than 5,000 people have been killed since the uprising began against President Bashar al-Assad. One young Tunisian was the trigger for the Arab Spring. A year on, for millions of people across the Middle East, it's not over. John Donison, BBC News.
No, it's not over. We'll have a think about that. Time magazine had these words to say. They were comparing, as I've already said, 1848 to 2011, which is quite a remarkable headline. The person of the year, according to Time magazine, was the protester. And it says on, you can just about read it, it says, history often emerges only in retrospect. Events become significant only when looked back on. No one could have known that when a Tunisian fruit vendor set himself on fire in a public square in a town barely on the map, he would spark protests that would bring down dictators in Tunisia, Egypt and Libya, and rattle regimes in Syria, Yemen and Bahrain, or that the spirit of dissent would spur Mexicans to rise up against the terror of the drug cartels, Greeks to march against unaccountable leaders, Americans to occupy public spaces to protest income inequality, and Russians to marshal themselves against a corrupt autocracy. And so it goes on. So these are, incredible events. And as we say, it isn't just around the Mediterranean. The Time magazine, which I've just scanned this in, all these black blobs that you see everywhere are actually where protests, large-scale protests, have taken place. And I couldn't fit the whole thing in, because all over in America there were dots, and all over there were dots. But, you know, that was the most dots I could fit in on the page, as it were. And when you think about it, around the Mediterranean, and it's a bit tricky to see this, but the Mediterranean is this middle bit here, and there's Tunisia, there's Libya, Egypt, Greece, and so on. Almost every single nation around the Mediterranean has had a change of government due to protest or financial crisis. So the Tunisian government's gone because of protest. The Libyan government's gone because of protest. The Egyptian government's gone because of protest. The Greek government has gone because of financial disaster. The Italian government's gone because of financial disaster. The Spanish government has gone this year because of financial disaster, and so has the Portuguese government. Every single government this year around the Mediterranean, bar Turkey, which is there, and bar Syria and Israel, have been changed in 2011. That's pretty remarkable. When you consider it's the Lord God who says that he is the one that sets up on this earth the rulers. The angels have been extremely busy, haven't they? Changing so many governments. That's just around the Med. You know, we could look at Korea and so on, but we won't. Here's a few more headlines. This is about Europe now. William Hague on the EU membership vote. We won't leave Europe, but it won't rule us. That's quite a significant statement, I think. New Euro Empire plot by Brussels. Death of a currency as Eurogeddon approaches. These are all recent headlines. Jose Manuel Barroso, solution to EU crisis is more integration, not division. German memo shows secret slide towards a super state. EU suffers worst split in history as David Cameron blocks treaty change. I just want to play you this video here, just to give you some ideas to where Europe might be headed next.
After Europe's debt woes brought it too close to the brink, Angela Merkel is now calling for closer ties within the region. The German Chancellor is due to address her party at a conference today, and they even adopt a motion to allow a Euro exit. Regional correspondent Linda Yu joins us with more. Mrs. Merkel, really speaking of political union, fiscal union, closer, 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 maybe that's the solution, Linda.
Well, it would be a solution. The economists have been saying for some time that part of this may well mean a fiscal union, but it's quite significant. She mentioned the term political union, and in fact, on German TV yesterday, she certainly did say that what they needed was perhaps even a federal Europe.
We need to make it clear that we want more Europe step by step. In other words, that the European Union and the...
I got fed up of listening to Angela Merkel, so there we are. That was Angela's talking. But there we are, political union, closer, closer, closer. And the significant thing there is about the people being allowed, there'll be a mechanism put in place to allow people to leave the euro. And a few nations coming together in much tighter political union. Very, very significant comments there. So I thought what we'd do now is, with all that sort of information and all those events that have been going on, let's open our Bibles and have a look at some verses that perhaps speak to us of these things. So we'll just deal quickly, first of all, with natural disasters, if we can. And if you could turn... there's going to be no verses, I don't think, I've plucked out here that you'll think, I've never read that before. You know these verses. But we're just going to line them up if we can now. So it's Luke chapter 21, verse 11. So we're thinking here of natural disasters. Does the Bible indicate that we would see the sorts of things that we're seeing right now? So in Luke 21, verse 11, we read there that there are going to be great earthquakes in diverse places, and famines and pestilences and fearful sights and great signs there shall be from heaven. It goes on to say, but before all of this, they're going to lay their hands on you, and it goes back to AD 70 and deals with the events of AD 70. So verse 11 is actually talking about things that are happening at the time of the end. Earthquakes, famines, pestilences, fearful sights, great signs there shall be from heaven, and surely we can see all of those things. I just want to point out one interesting thing. Just keep your finger in Luke 21 there, because we'll come back in just a second. But if you just flick back to Matthew chapter 8 and verse 24. In Matthew chapter 8 verse 24, it says there that, behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves. But he, Jesus, was asleep. You see that word tempest there? It's exactly the same word that's translated great earthquake in Luke chapter 21, verse 11. It's exactly the same word. So it's great seismic activity, it's great storm, something that is enormous like that, like the great tempest that Jesus was in, could also be translated in that type of way. Obviously has. I don't think there was an earthquake on the Sea of Galilee. It was a great, enormous storm that came down. So we could potentially see, using those two verses together, that when it talks about great earthquakes, it's also great tempests as well. So it isn't just earthquakes we're looking at. It is just huge activity that's going on both in the sky and on the earth. And that's why we're told that there are great signs there'll be from heaven. And of course, in verse 25 that we know very well, there'll be signs in the sun, moon and stars. Sorry, I'm back in Luke 21 here. Do apologise. Luke 21. Verse 25. There'll be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. And we know there's a symbolic side to that, but just as there's a symbolic, there's normally a physical, literal side first, and then the symbolic. And so we've seen with the tsunami, the sea and the waves physically roaring, and that must be a reference to those things as well. Just flick over to John chapter 16. There's lots of references about these particular things that we're just going to read in John chapter 16 verse 21. Doesn't talk here necessarily about storm and disaster and earthquakes, but it gives us an idea, I think, as to what the world will be like just before Jesus returns, because he says, and this is Jesus talking, a woman in verse 21, when she is in travail, hath sorrow because her hour is come. But as soon as she is delivered of the child, she remembereth no more the anguish for joy that a man is born into the world. And he goes on and says, I'm talking about myself, when I come back to the earth. So we know, and there's a number of verses that say this, there'll be great travail and anguish. And surely we're seeing great travail and anguish, not only with storm and tempest and earthquake, but also with the politics as well. There's other verses that we could look at, but because of time, we'll move on, I think. If you just go back to Luke chapter 21 just for a second. We'll just have a think now about revolutions. In verse 11, we read about the physical turmoil from a natural disaster point of view, didn't we, with earthquakes and pestilences and so on. The verse before that says, nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Now, I don't know if you've ever really stopped and thought about this. Why does Jesus say that nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom? Because surely he's just repeating himself. Surely a nation is the same as a kingdom, isn't it? Why does he say nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom? And really, It's the translators who probably haven't done the most fantastic job here. They're two different words that Jesus is using, but the word for nation literally means multitudes. It literally means multitudes against multitudes, nation against nation. Well, a nation against nation is war. But multitudes against multitudes is basically saying people against people, isn't it? And what is a revolution if it isn't people against people? So when the people in Egypt rise up against the people in Egypt, that isn't nation against nation. That is multitudes against multitudes. So what Jesus is saying, and interestingly, he puts it in that order. So he starts off by saying people against people, and then he says nation against nation. And that, brethren and sisters, is the order that if you see, that's actually happened. To start with, the people have fought against each other. Next minute, Britain declares war, and so does NATO, on Libya. So then you've got nation fighting nation. At the minute you've got in Syria people fighting people, it will lead to nation fighting nation in Syria's case as well. Absolutely categoric, there will be a war over Syria shortly. So to me that's quite interesting. Jesus is saying plainly that there will be revolution. There's no other word for people fighting against people, because he's categorised the next bit with nation against nation. What else shall we have a look at? Come back and have a look at... Oh, well, just while we're in Luke 21, obviously where it talks there in verse 25 about on earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Well, we know surely that these things are talking not only about the physical waves, but the people as well. How do we know that? How do we know that sea and waves are symbolic of people and nations? Well, we know it because of Ezekiel chapter 26. So if you just want a quick look. Am I going a bit too fast here? It's because I've got a million and one verses in front of me here. Come and have a look at Ezekiel 26 verse 3. Just one particular verse that's hopefully proving to you that the sea and the waves are symbolic of people and nations. In verse 3 of Ezekiel 26, therefore thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Tyrus, and will cause many nations to come up against you, as the sea causes his waves to come up. So God says, just as the nations are going to come against Tyre, it's going to be like the sea. And again, remarkably, there was a literal sea that came over ancient Tyre, but real people came against ancient Tyre. So we've got there both aspects happening, the literal and the symbolic coming in. Keep going back just slightly into Isaiah chapter 19. See what you make of this. Bearing in mind, we've seen great revolution happen in Egypt. Egypt's a very significant country in prophetical terms, especially at the time of the end. We perhaps overlook it to some extent. But here we are in Isaiah chapter 19, verse 2. The chapter kicks off. It's all about the burden of Egypt. But look what it says in verse 2. I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians. And they shall fight every one against his brother and every one against his neighbour, city against city and kingdom against kingdom. Interesting, isn't it, in the light of what we've seen with the Egyptians rising up. And you might say, well, this probably is all historical. I mean, has it got any relevance to 2011? Well, I believe, brethren and sisters, it most certainly has. If you have a look at verse 4... Have a look at this. Now, we could do a whole Bible class on this. But have a look in verse 4. The Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, who is this cruel lord that comes down and rules over Egypt at a time when there's been revolution between Egyptian and Egyptian? The answer is the King of the North. Daniel 11 clearly says that when the King of the North comes down, he goes straight through Israel and ends up in Egypt. And here's the remarkable link between verse 4 and Daniel chapter 8, which also talks about this very same king, a latter-day Antiochus Epiphanes, because you see there in verse 4, he's a cruel lord and a fierce king. Now that word fierce is very rare in the Hebrew. It only occurs a few times in the whole of the Old Testament. And the other time that word fierce occurs is in relation to the fierce king of Daniel chapter 8, who stands against Christ, who is the latter-day Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the original king of the north. So there's a direct link between that verse. So one day, brethren and sisters, what I'm saying to you is, a Russian ruler, maybe Putin, comes down through Israel and will end up in Egypt. He'll be a fierce and cruel king that rules over Egypt for a time, because that's what the Bible says he does. He even sets up a tabernacle there. And when he's there, he's fierce. And all of this comes after Egyptian fighting Egyptian, which we've also seen. But read it yourself. Have a look again at Isaiah chapter 19. There seems to me... And the link to the fierce king, if you want to make a note of that, is Daniel 8, verse 23. If you want a note of the verse that talks about this latter-day king of the north being fierce. What else should we have a look at? Just while you're there in Isaiah chapter 19, have a look at Isaiah chapter 17. Verse 12. And this you'll see in a minute is in context for what's going on right now. So Isaiah chapter 17 verse 12. Woe to the multitude of many people which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nation shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them. And they shall flee far off and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. This is the gathering of many nations. This is the multitude of people like the noise of the sea. And how astoundingly wonderful that at the very time the revolutions began, God caused an earthquake to happen that sent physically water pouring across the land, as we saw it, taking cars and houses and ships and boats before it. Absolutely at the same time it all began. Amazing, isn't it? He says, the multitude of many people make a noise like the noise of the seas. And he demonstrated to us what was going to happen before it even did. We could also, if we had more time, think about... perhaps we just have a quick flick over to Revelation 16. And again, you can imagine this is a Bible class in its own right. Just to get our heads around what's going on in Revelation 16. So in about 30 words, I'm going to try and give an hour's worth of Bible class here. So in Revelation 16, this chapter is about predominantly the French Revolution. Right? That's what it's predominantly about. Which is hundreds of years ago. 200 years ago plus. Because it went on for some time, didn't it? And that's what this chapter's about. But when you come to it, when you look in verse 13, there's these strange few verses that says, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and to the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that's watching and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. So this chapter leaps from the French Revolution, and I haven't proved that to you in any way, I understand, but it leaps from the French Revolution right up to Armageddon. And the bit that connects the two, brethren and sisters and friends, is the spirit of these devils that are like frogs that are coming out of the dragon and the mouth of the beast and the mouth of the false prophet. Now, if you look at the French Revolution, it was all to do with revolution. It was all the people uprising and saying, it's people power. We're not putting up with the tyranny of the French monarchy or the religious rulership for that matter, and we're going to turn them upside down and get rid of them. And the principles and the doctrines that came out of the French Revolution were the wicked, godless teachings that have come out of the French Revolution that have infected this country. They are the teachings of humanism and democracy. They are the teachings that say that man is the ultimate thing on this planet. There is no God. It's I can do whatever I want to do as long as I don't hurt somebody else. And that's why we get homosexuality, because people are consenting. Well, what's the problem? And that's where all the human rights, women's rights, gay rights, animal rights, all these rights spawned out of this. And it's the very disease that's infected the world that's causing people to say, I'm going to fight for my rights. And I'm not going to put up with these dictates. I'm going to turn them on their head. I'm going to kill people. I'm going to be violent and overcome. That's the spirit that's here. And it's the spirit that we're told that gathers the nations to Armageddon. And brethren and sisters, it's underway. And if you can't see Time magazine with 1848 versus 2011 and just see how wonderful that is, it may as well say, go and read Revelation 16, because that's what it's telling you to do. It's quite a wonderful thing. The other bit, that's revolutions done with just for now. What about Israel and the division of the land? Let's just quickly look at a few verses in relation to that. Have a look at Joel chapter 3. Are you coping with all this? Is it... Tell me when you've had enough and I'll just stop. Ollie's waving at the back now. Right, have a look here at Joel chapter 3, verse 2. Again, words we know very, very well. Joel 3, verse 2. I will also gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. Now, this is quite an interesting verse because it's telling us that all nations will come down. But it says that they have parted God's land. And that word parted literally means divided. If you've got a modern version, it will say divided. So there's a division of the land of Israel. And what did we see? But all the nations now, well, not every single one, but many nations saying, yeah, we'll recognise a Palestinian state. Yes, we'll recognise it too. As soon as a nation says we recognise a Palestinian state, in your mind, think this. That nation who's declared that has just divided God's land in two. Because where do you think the Palestinian state is? It's on God's land. Make no mistake about it. Look in Numbers 22, and God details out the land before Moses went in with the people. Well, Moses didn't go in, but he spoke to Moses before they went in. He said, these are the borders of your land. And the eastern border, it tells you categorically, is the Jordan River. Two tribes were actually given dispensation to live the other side of the Jordan, but God doesn't say that. Moses says the Jordan is your... God says the Jordan is your eastern boundary. Well, of course, when you divide Israel in two, the Jordan would no longer be the eastern boundary of Israel. It would be somewhere nearer Jerusalem. So there's some dividing of the land, and that is, I believe, what we're seeing. But just have a look at verse 4. As if you can almost just hear God's incredulity at really what's going on, because in verse 4 he says, yea, what have you to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon and the coasts of Philistia? It's quite interesting he says those places, because Philistia and the coast of Philistia is modern day Gaza. And the inhabitants of Tyre are actually, it's the stronghold of Hezbollah. So the two terrorist organisations that want to wipe Israel off the map are specifically mentioned here in this verse. And God says, what have you to do with me, Hezbollah? What have you got to do with me, Hamas? The answer is absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. And those two nations, or peoples, I should say, rather than nations, are also mentioned in Psalm 83. Again, a famous psalm, but worth just a quick look. In Psalm 83, this chapter is happening now. We try and fit it into place with the Russian invasion and so on, but these events are happening at the same time. Verse 3 says that these people have taken crafty counsel against thy people, the Jews. Verse 4, they have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. They've consulted together with one consent, they're confederate against you. And then there's a list of all of these nations, and if you have a look in verse 7, there they are again. The Philistines and the inhabitants of Tyre. Every single one of those peoples that are mentioned there is significant. It's significant, it says, the tabernacles of Edom. It's significant that it's talking about the inhabitants of Tyre and not just, Lebanon or something like that. These are all absolutely and deadly accurate descriptions of the people that want to destroy and wipe Israel off the map. So all this is going on, and the division of the land is, as we can see, underway. I just want to quickly talk to you about Syria, because Syria is very much in the news at the minute, and it's going to be even more so in the near future. Come and have a look at Isaiah chapter 17. Brethren and sisters, these verses that we're about to read have not been fulfilled, ever, which means they must be fulfilled in the future. The question is when? My answer is soon. Because in Revelation chapter 17 verse 1, we read here about the burden of Damascus. It's in the same set of chapters that we've already looked at with the burden of Egypt. All of these burdens are actually being replayed out right now before our very eyes. But here we are with the burden of Damascus, Damascus being the capital city of Syria. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap, and it never has been taken away from being a city, ever. In fact, its claim is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, city on earth. It's still there. But it's going to be taken away. Look at verse 3. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, another word for Israel, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria, and they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall wax thin, or be made thin, sorry, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. In other words, there's a conflagration that takes place over Syria, and it results in the complete and utter destruction, in fact one might say annihilation, of the capital city of Damascus, of Syria. So Damascus is gone. And at that very same time that happens, what does it say? The fortress, in other words, the strength of Ephraim, shall cease. And and in the following verse, in verse 4, the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and his fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. In other words, when this cataclysmic destruction happens on Syria, Israel is incredibly weakened at that time and is left. It's still there, unlike the kingdom of Syria, which has gone. Israel remains, but greatly weakened. And if you've seen the headlines just over the last 2 weeks, you'll realise that both nations have threatened these exact things that are here. Israel has threatened to completely destroy the Assad dynasty, including Damascus, if if Damascus decides to launch any military attack upon Israel to divert attention away from its crisis with the revolutions. Assad has threatened to send thousands upon thousands of missiles pouring down on Tel Aviv and other parts of Israel. These things are going to happen. These things are going to happen. Now, I don't know when they're going to happen, but it seems to me that this crisis in Syria is not going away. None of the other people who've risen up against any other leader have backed down. And in fact, if you keep listening to the news, it's just worse and worse and worse. What is going to happen? This has got to happen. It happens, I believe, before Russia comes down. This takes place before. You see, the remarkable thing is, the ancient king of the north, who we've already mentioned, was Syria. And the question has always been, why is it Russia in Ezekiel 38 that comes down and finishes Israel off in effect and comes sweeping through? Why Russia? Why is Syria not even mentioned? And some have said, well, Syria makes a peace treaty. I don't think Syria will ever make a peace treaty. That is not what the scriptures say. The scriptures say that there is utter and complete destruction of Syria. And at that point, I believe, the mantle of the king of the north passes from Syria to Russia. And the stage is set of a greatly weakened Israel. But you might say, well, hold on, they're living in peace and security and all the rest of it. But actually, in Ezekiel 38, it does not say at the point that Russia comes down, they are living in that state. It actually says that he thinks an evil thought while they are living in a state of overconfidence. And brethren and sisters, I could show you more slides from the World Watch this year that say that's precisely the current attitude of Israel. One of prosperity, enormous prosperity, and total overconfidence in themselves. I've got headlines that say precisely that, which mirrors exactly. So in other words, Russia puts a plan in place to come down while Israel's in that state. When it does come down, it may not be living in this great time of peace and security. We might actually see some peace agreements coming in at some point. Just while we're in Isaiah 17, look at verse 12. Does that ring any bells? It should do, because we read it 5 minutes ago. There it is. In the same chapter of the destruction of Syria, we've got the multitudes of people making a noise like the noise of the seas and the rushing of many nations. Very, very similar descriptive language to Joel 3, where God says, I'm bringing all nations against Jerusalem. I can't see the time at the back. Have you got 2 minutes to look at Europe, or have you had enough? Richard, you might be the last man sitting there at this rate. Let me just what do I do with Europe quickly? Have a look at Daniel chapter 2. You try and fit a whole year into 55 minutes. It's quite tricky. Daniel chapter 2, verse 42. Again, words I think we know very well. This is talking about Europe. This is talking about the Roman Empire, in effect, that exists at the time of the end. In verse 42, it says, as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom, this final kingdom that exists at the very end, shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, another reference there to revolution and democracy, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings, the 10-toe kings, if you like, that exist at the end, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. This is the return of Jesus and the establishment of the kingdom of God. Now, interestingly, on the screen here, I got this off the BBC website yesterday, and it gives you all the outcomes that could come out of the current crisis in Europe. So there's an unravelling, there's a meltdown, there's a depression, there's inflation, there's divorce, there's Phoenix from the ashes, and there is greater union. In other words, the euro problem is that you've got all these 27 different nations, all with different governments, trying to run a common currency. It doesn't work unless you've got a common banking system and a common political government over it setting common taxes, which there isn't within Europe at the minute, and that's why the euro's in crisis. So the only way to put it right is to actually bind the nations together as a superstate. And what the BBC wrote upon here is that the European Union turns into a political federation. As the financial malaise keeps doggedly returning, so the Eurozone governments call more and more summits and come up with more and more proposals for closer union. Eventually, they agree a complete political union, a democratically elected government in Brussels. They can borrow with the backing of all 17 countries and can spend money whenever they need, rescuing banks, paying unemployment benefits, financing investment, and on it goes. The UK and other EU countries not signed up to joining the euro are asked to exit the EU altogether and join a looser free trade area with much less political influence. Isn't that interesting? Here's interesting, in just listening to the words of Daniel 2 that talked about in verse 42, the nations are partly strong and partly broken. That means brittle or weak. What did President Sarkozy of France say 2 weeks ago? There can be no common currency without economic convergence, without which the euro will be too strong for some and too weak for others. He's talking about the strong and the weak there. That's what he said a couple of weeks ago. Let me just quickly show you this. I only thought of this the other day, so I'm running this past you as a bit of a thought. You can't see that at all, can you? Because that actually, that's funny it's gone like that. Because I can see dead clearly on my screen here, a whole map of Europe. You can see a purple blob. Well, anyway, you'll have to look at it afterwards. That purple blob, which I can't understand why it hasn't come out right, that purple blob there is the shape of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire is in effect going to come back on the earth again. It's called a beast in Revelation 17. It's going to rise from a bottomless pit. Now here's the interesting thing. The Holy Roman Empire consisted of that territory there. And put on the map here are the nations, the shapes, if you like, of the current nations that cover that particular area. They are Netherlands, Germany, Poland, Czech Republic, Austria, Italy, Switzerland, France, Slovenia, Belgium and Luxembourg are covered by that, or partly covered by it. Obviously, France comes down here, off there, but some of France was covered by the Holy Roman Empire. So I've picked every single nation that it touched or totally covered. And there are 11 nations. One of them, Switzerland, has never ever been in the euro or wanted anything really to do with Europe. Which then gives you 10 nations. You'll notice that none of the southern nations that are in current trouble, like Greece, like Portugal, like Spain, are involved in this group of 10. Now the reason I sort of found that quite interesting is because when you look at Revelation 17, of course, here is something that I think is quite interesting and something that we've puzzled about as a community for a long time. Because in Revelation 17 verse 12, we're given the interpretation of this particular beast which has risen out of the bottomless pit, which I'm saying to you is a resurrected Holy Roman Empire. And in Revelation 17 verse 12 it says, the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, or 10 nations if you like, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. So there are 10 kings, 10 rulers of the nations that say, we're going to give our power and our strength to you, Mr. Beast. And Mr. Beast is the resurrected Holy Roman Empire. That's what it is. Because the last time we saw the beast was in the state of the Holy Roman Empire. The Roman Empire covered a gigantic territory, including Britain. The Holy Roman Empire is what will be resurrected, and those core nations are going to come together in a union. Now, I might be wrong on that. It could be different nations, and it might not be 10. But isn't it interesting that there's a group now, a core of nations, that are saying, you lot go your own way, we're all going to join hands, we're going to form a federation, we're going to form a political union to get through this crisis. They will never, ever give up on the dream of uniting Europe politically. And it's led by Germany, which is why Angela Merkel popped up there. She's the one everybody's listening to. And Germany was the ruler of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was the first Reich. The second Reich was the Germanic Empire. The Third Reich, we've all heard of the Third Reich, or the Third Empire was Hitler's empire. This is the final version of it about to appear before us again, run by Germany. So the UK doesn't actually have to physically say we're off. We're just forced out because there's a group that come together, which is far more likely. And far more scriptural, I think, to think of it in those ways. So finally, last little bit, I said I would do this, and you invited me, so I don't care now. So I'm just quickly going to say a couple of things are going to happen, quite possibly. So in Ezekiel 38, just have a look at this one. I'm not going to go through all these, don't worry, I'm just want to cover this thing. Putin is out of power as we sit here right now. But he's going to be restored to power in the next few months. Despite the uprisings in Russia, I believe he will be back in power. Now, what is remarkable about that is that in Ezekiel 38, which is talking about Russia, we read there about God talking to a man called Gog. We know it's a man because he says, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him." Gog always was a real and historical person, none other than ruler of the Magogites, which ruled in southern Russia. And Gog, therefore, isn't some airy-fairy sort of symbolic thing. He is a man. Look what it says. "I am against thee," in verse 3, "O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and I will turn you back and put hooks in your jaws and bring you forth with all your army." So the bit I want you to notice here is in verse 4 when it says, "I will turn you back." Almost every single other time that word is translated, it's either translated as return or restore. In other words, what it really should be saying is, "I will restore you. I will return you." The back bit, it's one of the very few times it's ever translated in that way. It's almost, if I could give you a load of references to look, to say that it normally means to restore. What God is saying to Gog, the leader of the Russian people, is, "I am going to restore you." And then what does he do? "I will then put hooks into your jaws and bring you forth when you've been restored." There are headlines that have been over the last number of weeks about Putin being restored to power despite the numbers of people on the streets in Moscow. God says, "I'm going to restore you. You can have people on the streets." If God wants to restore him, he will restore him. And once he's restored, the king of the north can eventually come down. Now, I might be wrong on that, but it seems interesting to me that he's about to be restored to power. Iran, that's in the news. This is another thing that could happen. But I think Iran is going to be spared. We know Iran plays a part at the end, because in Ezekiel 38, look at verse 5. What's the nation that's mentioned at the beginning of Ezekiel 38, verse 5, but Iran? So Iran must survive whatever happens. So even though there's war games going on, even though tension's enormous, America hasn't got the political will to fight. And so Iran stays there. Israel might attack, but I think before that happens, the crisis with Syria comes first. And the attention is diverted away from Iran to Syria. In fact, brethren and sisters and friends, Syria is just a pawn of Iran. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is just a pawn of Syria, and the three are linked together. And so if the tension increases too much on Iran, it will trigger something in Syria to divert attention. And I don't know if you realise, but in the last 48 hours, the currency of Iran has collapsed overnight. And that's because of the tension between America and Iran. Everybody suddenly got very frightened that this could go wrong. Iran is being very much backed into a corner, but he's also incredibly stirred up and he's ready for action. But it might well trigger something over in Syria. So Iran, whatever happens, survives to fight against Israel with Russia. We've talked about Syria. That could come soon. The destruction of Damascus could be something on our screens in the not too distant future. It will leave Israel weakened and maybe be forced into making some peace treaty later on in 2012. Something that says, okay, we're weak and we've lost that, we'll make some agreement. And when there's a cry of peace and safety, sudden destruction comes. And I'll conclude with this slide here, because Rome has been fairly quiet in 2011, but it's about to get noisy in 2012. The Vatican was, this was the headline in Israel's national news, December the 15th, just a few days ago. The Vatican wants to lay its hands on Jerusalem, and it does. And it's going to get involved in this coming year. So those are the things that I think we should be looking for. Putin restored to power, lined up ready to be pulled down. Iran protected and guarded by Russia, because that's what it says in Ezekiel 38. But stirred up for action. Syria and Damascus destroyed. Israel weakened at that point, forced into a peace treaty. Rome makes a move on Jerusalem, and Russia at some point comes down. And all of that we might not see, because the Lord might have returned at any point, brethren and sisters, between now and all of these things happening. They are remarkable things, and I do apologise for going on so long, Richard.
Apologise to me, Brother Andy. That was, see, brothers and sisters, I told you it would be good.